Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Tuesday, August 3rd. Joe, we've got a lot going on today, including breaking news from Tokyo.
We really do. And Willie and I, speaking of Tokyo, back last night on the red eye, we were at one of these old timers things, you know, for synchronized swimmers that were gold medalists in the late 80s.
Willie, you still fit in that bathing suit, Joe, which is very impressive. That little, I don't know what they call it nowadays, but it's small.
Speedo. No, there's Speedo.
Speedo. Yeah.
They're still Speedos. But Willie and I mean, crowd favorites.
Way
because,
too
of course,
early for
remember
that.
We did the 1988 games. I think it was Seoul. I don't know. It's all a blur. The Summer of Love and all that. But, Willie, we have breaking news items lining up. I know we wanted to stay for another day of the fun and festivities, but had to come back because big breaking news, of course. Wrongly convicted, deeply misunderstood, former governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich. Yes, the man who considers himself the Mandela of our time is actually suing so he can run for office again, Willie. It's just like, it's the end of Horton Hears a Who.
Coming.
You're just a little sound coming out from the distance of hope. Maybe somebody like Blago is there to save American politics from itself.
There's a name, a blast from the past you haven't heard in a while. Yeah, he said on our set, I don't know what the year was, 10 years ago, and said, I'm the Abraham Lincoln of our time. He said, they're throwing me in jail for trying to get health care to little kids, and if that's a crime, I'll happily march my own way into prison.
Oh,
so
God.
Blago, in a previous time, we would laugh, but maybe in our current political climate, Blago will rear his head once again. We have some actual breaking news. Our viewers can see it on the bottom bottom of the screen there. Simone Biles, who returned and to participate in the balance beam, just won a bronze medal. So she medals after sitting out the games. Everyone knows the story by now. The four-time Olympic gold medalist, considered the greatest gymnast in the world, 24 years old, withdrew from the team competition, then withdrew from the individual all-around and all the events up till today when she announced she would participate despite still having the problem with what is known in the world of gymnastics as twisties, where you can't tell up from down, said she's still suffering from that. Despite that, hit her routine pretty well, a couple of wobbles, but goes home with a bronze medal from these Tokyo games where she has been the focus despite not participating until today.
Wow. Okay. Well, we are following several developments surrounding the coronavirus this morning. The Biden administration reached its goal of getting 70% of American adults at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. But COVID cases across the country are still on the rise, and hospitals in many areas are once again overwhelmed. NBC News correspondent Miguel Almaguer has more.
As the crisis deepens at hospitals and hotspots, the numbers are staggering and sobering. Surpassing last summer's average for new cases, our nation has again recorded over 100,000 infections in a single day. The Delta variant filling ICUs and killing more Americans from week to week.
If you get sick with the Delta variant, we estimate that you could infect about five other unvaccinated people. More than twice as many as the original strain.
Though it comes nearly a month after the president's 4th of July goal, 70% of adults are at least partially vaccinated. But every day, more breakthrough infections are being reported. Senator Lindsey Graham, now in quarantine after announcing his infection, says being fully vaccinated kept his COVID symptoms from being far worse.
Even with a high vaccine effectiveness, most of these infections are going to be asymptomatic or mild.
With daily infections predicted to double by fall, some hospitals are already seeing a surge worse than before.
A federal disaster team is arriving in Louisiana, where ICU beds are short on supply and a new face mask mandate indoors is back in place. Lines for testing stretching for hours today in Florida, after the state just set its pandemic record for new cases and patients hospitalized.
They're asking for the vaccine now. They're like, just give it to me. We want to get it, which now they have to wait, unfortunately, until they get better and get out of the hospital.
Hoping to boost inoculations in New Jersey, the governor says healthcare workers like those at nursing homes must be vaccinated or face weekly testing. New York's governor encouraging businesses to require proof of vaccination from patrons, but stop short of mandating masks indoors. The push to inoculate and to save lives, as hospitals lose more Americans every day.
All right, more now on what's happening in Florida. The state has become a new epicenter for the virus, Florida, as CDC data shows that new case numbers there make up nearly a fifth of all new U.S. cases. Let's bring in the president and the CEO of Jackson Health System in Miami-Dade, Carlos Magoya. And, sir, I'll start by asking how many cases, how many patients you have in the Jackson healthcare system compared to, say, 2 weeks ago, and how bad is the situation in Florida overall? Why is it this bad?
Well, we are at Jackson, we are 230 patients relative to where we were 4 weeks ago. We were 50 patients. So we almost fivefold the number that we were. The only good news is we're still 45% from the peak from last year. Miami-Dade County is the most vaccinated county in all the state of Florida, with 78% of our population vaccinated. There's still about 350 to 400,000 people unvaccinated. At 230, by the way, all but seven are unvaccinated. And the seven patients that are not, that are vaccinated, are transplant patients that are immunocompromised. So if you take those out, really, we're 100% unvaccinated. The difference between this year and last year for Florida, one just quickly, is that last year it was a South Florida surge. Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach had the issues while the rest of the state was not that much. Now what's happening, the rest of the state, parts of North Florida, are running 150, 200% of the numbers from last year. That's why the numbers are so large in the entire state. Definitely a correlation between high hospitalization and low vaccination rates in the individual counties.
So if you take out the people, you say, with underlying conditions, the unvaccinated make up 100% of the people that's in your hospital right now. Can you help us out? Because we've been reading everyday headlines. Florida makes up 20% of the COVID cases in America. Around those numbers, that still seems to be the case. Do you know why? Have you heard any good operating theories on why the situation in Florida is so bad right now?
Yes, what I said before. I mean, if you look at places like Jacksonville, Duval County, and Clay County, they were under, they still are 43 and 48% vaccinated. They're suffering tremendously. And all the rural counties up in the northern part of the state that have less than 50% vaccination, they're having the highest amount of infection rate and much, much higher than last summer. Down in South Florida, we're seeing a little milder. Although the numbers are huge for us, they're not as big as they were last summer because we have a much higher vaccination rate.
So, Mr. Magoya, there's been talk about whether or not there should be mask mandates in Florida. That conversation is happening in cities and states across the country. Governor DeSantis in your state saying he's not going to mandate masks inside of schools. What's your view about kids in schools? Should they have to wear masks this fall?
Well, obviously, look, we've been at the masking for 18 months, and there are an awful lot of people that are aggressively against masking. Yes, masking does help. And obviously, it's important to be able to wear masking wherever possible. But the number one answer that we're trying to focus on in a single message is about vaccination. Hopefully, we'll have a vaccine here soon for kids under 12. And I hope when that happens that we will vaccinate as many kids as possible. And again, even though we're at 78%, we need to get that number even higher than that to be able to continue to reduce that. We're 90% Delta. We're finding new variants down here that are coming from other parts of the world. And the infection rates are very high. The only answer is vaccination.
All right. President and CEO of Jackson Health System in Miami-Dade, Carlos Mangoia, thank you so much for being with us. I wanted, Willie, wanted to ask you, also Mika, you and I, Willie, will be sending kids back to school pretty soon. I think I'm in a little different position than you, only because Jack, as healthy as he has upper respiratory issues at times. So, we're, mom and dad are going to be, telling him wear a mask until a lot of this clears, even though he's vaccinated. Just because, as we heard from the doctor, people are completely healthy that have the vaccine usually have any significant symptoms. What are your thoughts about mask mandates and kids getting back in school and whether they should be masked or not? I'm still up in the air with it, though. I've always said, safety first. It seems to make sense, at least in the beginning part of the fall, to mask them up if this Delta variant is still whipping around all over the place.
Yeah, and it really depends on your school and what age kids are in there, because as Carlos just said, the kindergartners through fifth or sixth grade, under 12 years old, in other words, they're not vaccinated. So if you're in a school that's K through 5 or K through 8 or K through 12, then that's sort of a different calculus because you've got half of the school that has not been vaccinated. But for older kids, hopefully they can get back in school. But it really is the back in school without masks. But it really is the story of the country where we had this sort of celebration almost in June where we said, okay, I think we've done this. We can get back to school. We can get back to life in the fall. Boom, here comes the Delta variant. And all of a sudden that changes the dynamics to where a lot of schools are saying, okay, we announced in June or early July that school is back, fully normal, no masks, no distancing. We did it. We have kids are vaccinated. Come on back. Now they're pumping the brakes a little bit, I think, and saying, well, this Delta variant scares us a little bit. Let's take a look and maybe have kids wear masks, as you say, at least in the early stages of the fall.
Right.
Teachers, meanwhile, Joe, in New York already are pushing back, though, against a possible vaccine mandate by the governor here. Governor Andrew Cuomo suggested on Monday teachers should be mandated to get the vaccine if cases continue to rise. The teachers union fired back, writing a statement, quote, "We have advocated since the beginning of the year that any educator who wants a vaccine should have easy access to one. We would support local efforts to encourage more vaccinations, such as through programs that require that those who are not vaccinated get tested on a regular basis. But it is critical that districts come up with plans to make testing available on site and at no cost. What we have not supported is a vaccine mandate." So that's the New York State United Teachers Union, Joe, saying we don't support a vaccine mandate. Vaccine, if you want it, testing should be mandatory, though. That's the position of the union.
Yeah, it's a position every bit as ridiculous as if a pilot or if a flight attendant said, "Oh, I'm not going to take a vaccine," or if healthcare workers that take care of senior citizens deciding they're not going to get vaccines. It's ridiculous. You're going to have a teacher that, again, the teachers unions have been whining for the past 6 months, 9 months. We're not going to go back in to class until you give us vaccines. And then they have the chance of getting vaccines. And now they're saying, oh, wait, no, we don't want the vaccines. We don't want the mandate. Stephanie Ruhle wrote this. Let's go through a couple. Stephanie Ruhle wrote, "The teachers union fought against in-person learning last year because of health risks. Now they don't support the one thing that will definitely minimize health risks. Andrew Ross Sorkin, teachers whose entire professional mission is to educate and keep kids safe, won't require the vaccine among themselves. This after the union didn't want teachers in the classroom for nearly a year." Let that sink in, Mika. I've been saying it over the past month or two, and I said you could see this coming. Yeah. You just like my law professor, Professor Pearson, said you should be able to see this coming like a freight train out of the mist. It's coming at you that teachers who complained and used as an excuse, I will say it, you can say it now because they've shown their hand, an excuse. We can't go back into the class. Your kids are going to have to stay at home and do distance learning. They're going to have to stay home. Oh, these parents, they just want us to be their babysitters for their kids. We can't go back into class because of the vaccine. And now They're saying, don't make us get vaccines. You can't make us get vaccines. It's ridiculous. And you know what? I'll be really honest. My kids, Willie's kids, your kids, if they were still in school, that'd be okay. It'd be tougher socially, but academically, we have the means to take care of our children. And in fact, they did it last year with tutoring and extra help on the outside because it's a little harder to learn. But it's a truly disadvantaged. It's the kids from truly disadvantaged backgrounds, from working class backgrounds, who are the ones who fell furthest behind last year. And they're going to fall further behind this next year. And there are kids that have mental health challenges that need to be in classrooms and need to socialize. I'm not even talking to the teachers unions right now. I'm talking to the leaders, the people that have been elected to lead. They need to have the mandate. If you're a teacher and you want to teach in front of class of kids, you need to get vaccinated. And if you don't get vaccinated, you need to leave school.
Well,
I mean, you want to do your distance learning somewhere else? You do whatever. But kids need to be back in school. And there have to be safety precautions for those kids that are too young to get vaccines right now. Mm-hmm. And each school can individually decide the best way to do that. But unless a teacher has a medical condition that prevents him or her from getting that vaccine, they all need to get vaccines or they don't need to teach.
And here's the things that we've learned. There is science that has played out here. So it's not just science being given to you by the scientists who actually know the facts against the conspiracy theories that float around on social media and Facebook and all that. The facts have played out. The numbers show that if you're vaccinated, your chances of dying from COVID go way down to practically zero. If you are unvaccinated and you get COVID, you could end up in the hospital. All those in the hospital, 99% of them, are people who are unvaccinated. Now, if you're in a state like Florida, which is number one right now in COVID cases and is experiencing a surge, and you have a governor who's saying, we don't need mask mandates in school, when you have a Delta variant that is ripping through the population in the South and hitting younger people, even children, even babies, and killing them with the Delta variant, and you're saying that you don't need mask mandates in your school, you're completely out of step with what is right and what should be done to protect your population. Now, if you go to your neighboring states in the South, you have governors pleading with people to get vaccinated, saying what needs to be said. I can't teach you common sense. You need to get vaccinated, begging people to get their vaccine. And yet in Florida, it's a party.
Well, no,
in Florida, you don't really need a mask if you're a kid.
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Well,
I'd put a mask on my kid if I were sending them to a Florida school.
You have had Ron DeSantis saying several times that people need to get vaccinated. He's gotten that word out there. It is too early, though, for any governor to make a blanket statement on masks. What, like, for instance, again, as Willie said, the children that I think most of us should be concerned about are those who are too young to get the vaccine. Those who are right now, I believe, under 12. Those are the ones that need to be taken care of.
That's correct.
And then I guess, you know, Willie, this is a thing that drives me crazy about this discussion. It always has. We've always said here the same thing. Follow the science. Follow the science. Well, sometimes the science changes because the virus changes. Because the virus
Because people don't get vaccinated.
The virus has a variant. Things move. And it's a fast-moving game. And when it's a fast-moving game, you've got to be agile. You've got to be able to adapt to it. So 2 months ago, it looked like the science said no masks. A lot of people didn't get vaccinated. The Delta variant flew through the United States. We're needing to adjust there. There can be no hard, fast rules for all 50 states because some states have been vaccinated, have much higher vaccination rates than other states. But again, this whole idea that I'm always going to be against a mask mandate or I'm always going to be for a mask mandate without looking at the science seems a little bit ridiculous right now.
Yeah, and wearing a mask in school is a pain and it's uncomfortable and it's not fun. But what's worse, as you say, is learning from home for another year, where so many kids fall through the cracks. So many kids, millions, by the way, not thousands, millions of kids have lost contact with their schools. They're not even going to school. They're not participating in any way. So whatever it takes to get kids back into classrooms, I think most educators would agree, teachers would agree, is best. And also we should point out that there are very, very low numbers. We've learned this over the last year. You talk about learning and growing and figuring this out. There's no indication that schools were big vectors of transmission. In other words, these schools, when they went back in, they didn't become super spreaders. So we know a lot more than we did a year ago that schools don't spread a lot of disease. And we got the thing through the miracle of science and doctors and scientists and the government and pharmaceutical companies. We got this miracle vaccine that should allow our kids to be back in school, should allow our teachers to be safe. And so you'd like to think the teachers would want that for themselves, but also for all the kids in this country. There's a new report from the Kaiser Family Foundation that shows breakthrough cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are extremely rare among those who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. According to this report, those fully vaccinated show an infection rate that is well below 1% in all reporting states. The rates of death among fully vaccinated people were effectively zero. During a White House briefing yesterday, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky looked to drive home that message.
The Delta variant is highly contagious. To put this in perspective, if you get sick with the Alpha variant, you could infect about two other unvaccinated people. If you get sick with the Delta variant, we estimate that you could infect about five other unvaccinated people, more than twice as many as the original strain. In all of this, there is still good news. Our vaccines are working to prevent severe illness, hospitalizations, and death.
So, Joe, that's what we're underlining here is that we hear these screaming headlines about breakthrough cases. And of course, there are people who've been vaccinated, getting COVID-19 again. But as Dr. Walensky pointed out there and others have made very clear, if you get it and you've been vaccinated, sometimes you're asymptomatic. Most of the time you're asymptomatic, but you certainly in almost all cases don't get sick enough to be in the hospital or to die. We were talking earlier about Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who announced yesterday he did get COVID-19 despite the fact that he's been vaccinated. He says his symptoms are mild. He's going to isolate for 10 days, but he thanked and made very clear. He thanked those who developed the vaccine. He said he was grateful he had it. He encouraged everyone else to get it because of that vaccine, although he has COVID-19 now, he doesn't actually feel sick and will not be put in a hospital.
Well, and Willie, as you know, every New York Yankee this year has decided that they were going to get COVID. They've gotten COVID. They've gotten through it. I exaggerate slightly. Gerrit Cole, breaking news. Gerrit Cole, it appears, has tested positive for COVID. Yeah. We'll be following that news this morning. But this is what Lindsey wrote yesterday. Again, just to underline what Willie said, it was important for Lindsey to write this, and we're grateful that he did. I feel like I have a sinus infection, and at present time, I have mild symptoms. I will be quarantining for 10 days. I'm very glad I was vaccinated, because without vaccination, I'm certain I would not feel as well as I do now. My symptoms would be far worse. Again, a very important message. It's also a very important message
for that state.
For that state. It's also a very important message that what you were just talking about a minute ago and what we saw in the package. And that is the odds of getting sick, really sick, after a vaccination are so low. They're extraordinarily low. I think you have more of a chance of dying of a bee sting. Or a lightning strike, I think I read in the Washington Post, than you do of dying after getting a vaccine. And that's important to remember. And it's also important, Mika, to remember that how many people have gotten the vaccine. So we've hit the 70% threshold Biden was looking for. So I don't know, what is that, 175 million, maybe 180 million Americans. And we all know. Most of us know people. We've heard a story. Somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who also had a reaction to a vaccine. Which again, the more people that take it, the closer we get to 80%, 90%, the more stories we're going to hear. But again, the odds are so extraordinarily low that you would hope that the FDA would move towards approval very quickly. They've been moving toward approval. The Wall Street Journal editorial page this morning says they need to move faster. I agree. It does seem like they're focusing their resources more on moving towards full and final approval of the vaccine. They have so much information from so many people. I expect that to come soon, and hopefully that'll move even more Americans to getting vaccinated.
All right. Still ahead on Morning Joe, the eviction moratorium has expired. And now the White House is scrambling to find a solution for millions of Americans affected by it. Plus, with midterm elections drawing closer, President Biden offers a possible preview of how Democrats will take on Republicans, especially when it comes to voting rights. And the White House staffer who sparked former President Trump's first impeachment is telling his story. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman joins us ahead on Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Two more Washington, D.C. police officers who responded to the insurrection at the Capitol have died by suicide. Since the January 6th attack, four officers who defended the site that day have taken their own lives. Washington, D.C. police officer Gunther Hashida was found at his home on Thursday. He was an 18-year veteran of the force. Officer Hashida was assigned to the emergency response team with the Special Operations Division that helped protect the Capitol that day. We also learned that Officer Kyle DeFreitag, who is also of the D.C. Metro Police Force, died on July 10th. He was just 26 years old and had been with the department since November of 2016. Just days after the January 6th attack, two other officers died by suicide. Their families said their deaths were the result of the Capitol riot. More than 100 officers from D.C. and Capitol Police were injured defending the Capitol that day.
And you know, Willie, more than you need. When you look at what these officers have done, what they've been through, the hell that they've been through, being beaten up and brutalized by Americans, people who claim to love this country, getting beaten and brutalized with an American flag. You looked at the testimony last week, could see the trauma that was evident in their face from what they went through. And still being mocked and ridiculed by a small percentage of people, but people who, my God, just heartless, claiming that they were actors.
I mean,
it's heartbreaking. Nobody was acting here, and these suicides. This continues for a force that was deeply traumatized by the events of that day, as anybody would, and I guess. Especially now, after these two additional suicides, this is something that I'm sure the Capitol Police and the D.C. Police were already worried about before. But we're really going to have to put a focus on the mental health care of those who endured.
Well, you first have to believe what happened.
Well, everybody believes. Everybody knows what happened that day. People that are claiming they aren't are either have their heads buried in Facebook all day or are websites from Chinese cults, religious cults, or they're just again they're just thinking they're defending Donald Trump by defending this insurrection and these rioters, these mobsters, these terrorists, as the police officers themselves called them, terrorists. But Willie, we know what happened. We've seen what happened. We've seen these cops being beaten and brutalized with an American flag. I've seen their heads crushed. We've seen them lying on the ground, begging for their lives. That they have children, and they need our help. They need everybody's help. They need mental health counseling, just like we do for men and women who come back from war zones.
Yeah, when these officers signed up to become police officers, whether Capitol Police or DC Metro, I hesitate to think that they could even conceive of something like the pictures we're seeing right now. They knew they were going to have to defend the Capitol, perhaps from a terrorist act or a shooter. But something like this, an insurrection, a crowd of American citizens storming through and beating them with American flags and calling them the horrendous names that we heard in testimony before Congress last week. It's beyond heartbreaking. It's hideous that we're losing officers to suicide because of what they endured on that day. And it's even worse that there are many people in positions of great power in this country who continue to perpetuate the lies that drove the people to the Capitol and allow some Americans, a large percentage, unfortunately, according to a lot of polling in this country, to believe that what happened that day was just a regular tourist visit, or it was their right to be there, or that they actually did the right thing. So those people have chosen the defense of one man, Donald Trump, over the defense of our democracy and over the defense of police officers who were there that day. A sad state of affairs, question.
And Willie, they've sided with American terrorists over police officers. It's that simple. Let's bring in right now White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, and Pulitzer Prize winning columnist and associate editor of The Washington Post, and MSNBC political analyst Eugene Robinson. Gene, such tragic news. These Capitol Hill police officers, two more taking their own lives. Yeah. We've been talking for some time about the number of suicides for the men and women in uniform that came back from Iraq and Afghanistan. We're already now we've had four officers take their lives from that day.
Yeah, we have. And what a tragedy. You know, these traumatic events leave scars, and they leave scars of the kind that can't be seen. And I just hope that Metropolitan Police and Capitol Police and all the responding law enforcement agencies that day really do what is necessary to assess and to take care of the mental health of the officers who were brutalized. There's just no other way to say it. We were brutalized and traumatized and shocked and injured and with lasting scars. It's just four officers. I mean, that's just a tragic loss.
Yeah, Jonathan Lemire, from your reporting, how widespread is the disinformation on the Hill, on the Republican side, on the House side especially? We've heard Mitch McConnell come out a couple of times, even though he killed the 1-6 commission. We've heard him come out being very clear about the debt of gratitude that we owe for the Capitol Hill cops and the D.C. Metro police. But we haven't heard it from many other Republicans, have we? I mean, first of all, how widespread is this conspiracy theory that it was just another day at the Capitol? Or, you know, Ron Johnson, of course, tells a different lie every day, whips up another conspiracy theory every day. I'm curious, though, how are more Republicans coming out being supportive of these Capitol Hill cops, these police officers?
Well, we'll see. This news of these two suicides, truly heartbreaking and tragic, just came out late yesterday. So we'll see if others in Congress react to it. The House is home for recess. The Senate still here in session. But let's not, we should underscore two things. As you said, it was Mitch McConnell and other Republican senators who killed the bipartisan January 6th commission. We also know that it took until the 11th hour for Congress to put together funding to keep the U.S. Capitol Police going, that they were running out of money. And it took an emergency deal to keep that money going so they could keep protecting the Capitol, even after, of course, what happened 6.5 months ago on that tragic day. The conspiracy theories and those attempts to downplay what happened on January 6th, it's a little more prevalent on the House side than the Senate. Ron Johnson, you named him. He's the guiltiest offender, certainly on the Senate side, saying, as we have talked about here on the show previously, that he'd have been far more afraid had they been Black Lives Matter protesters as opposed to a mob of rioters carrying Trump flags. And others, you know, certainly Senator Ted Cruz and others have voiced some support. And let's remember, still voted to decertify, to not certify Joe Biden's election. Hawley, Cruz, they're the ones who that day still acted in allegiance with those who stormed the Capitol. But they've been quieter in terms of supporting them since. It's on the House. We've heard from a number of Republican congressmen who have downplayed that day, suggesting it was just like tourists gathering, saying that it's been overblown, suggesting these were patriotic Americans using their First Amendment right to express themselves. And they're saying that totally out of line with the facts and the tragic facts that we're seeing, you know, and frankly, as the death toll continues to rise, as this nation is going to be grappling with the aftermath of that day for months and years to come.
And look at those Trump signs everywhere. And Donald Trump trying to deny that this wasn't his riot, that this wasn't his insurrection, when in fact he was cheering it on from the White House, according to Republican senators, and of course called up Kevin McCarthy. And McCarthy asked him, begged him to shut it down, and he told McCarthy it wasn't his people. While he was cheering them on, McCarthy shouted at him and swore at him and called him a liar and said, how stupid do you think we are? Everybody knows. Look at all the Trump signs. These were all Donald Trump supporters in there. And right now, Mika, let's be clear about it. Republicans, they have a choice to make, and it's a very simple choice. You can either be on the side of American terrorists. That's what the cops call them that were getting brutalized with American flags. You can either be on the side of American terrorists, or you can be on the side of law enforcement officers, of police officers. It's that simple. Terrorists or cops. Pick a side. And if you decide that you do want to support law enforcement officers, if you do want to protect those who have protected you every day inside the United States Capitol, if you were a Republican, could you please, please offer your support publicly for law enforcement officers today in the Capitol, in the D.C. Metro Force? Please let them know how much you appreciate what they do for you every day, and specifically what they did to save your life on January the 6th, because right now they obviously aren't feeling that. They're hearing a lot of Republicans undermine them and attack them and claim that they're actors and claim that this was just another day on the Hill. And so when Republicans come out and say that, or when carnival barkers come out and say that, and you say nothing as a Republican member of Congress, you're sort of endorsing that.
Yeah.
All right. You don't hear me saying silence is violence or whatever that saying was last year. But in this case, they need you as a Republican to affirm your support for them. These are good people. They risk their lives for you. And they risked their lives for you on January the 6th. Just write a quick tweet. Thank them publicly. Let them know how much they mean to you. It'll mean the world to them, and it'll mean a world to their families.
There's something really wrong with you if you were to laugh at them and invalidate what happened and call them actors. There's something really wrong with you. Coming up, he was a key player in Donald Trump's first impeachment trial, and now Alexander Vindman is out with a new memoir recalling the fateful phone call between Trump and the president of Ukraine, and the unexpected consequences. He joins us next on Morning Joe.
The House began its investigation of the January 6th insurrection, although perhaps the most interesting exchange took place out of the hearing room as Congressman Jim Jordan struggled to answer a pretty basic question.
Yes or no, did you speak with President Trump on January 6th?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke with the president last week. I speak with the president all the time. I spoke with him on January 6th. I mean, I talk with President Trump all the time.
On January 6th, did you speak with him before, during, or after the Capitol was attacked?
I'd have to go. I spoke with him that day after, I think after. I don't know if I spoke with him in the morning or not. I just don't know. I'd have to go back and I mean, I don't know when those conversations happened. But what I know is I spoke with him all the time.
Oh, okay then. That sounds reasonable. You seem to be employing both the nervous energy and deeply suspicious denials normally reserved for Woody Allen. Why wouldn't I find that reassuring?
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Dad, my sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected officials is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I'll be fine for telling the truth.
And why do you have confidence that you can do that and tell your dad not to worry?
Congressman, because this is America. This is the country I've served and defended, that all of my brothers have served, and here, right matters.
Thank you, sir. Yield back.
November 19th, 2019, the day most of the country learned the name Alexander Vindman. The now retired lieutenant colonel was the one who sounded the alarm about what he heard on then President Trump's July 25th, 2019 phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, which eventually led to President Trump's first impeachment trial. And retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Vindman joins us now. He is the author of the new book out today called Here, Right Matters, An American Story. Colonel Vindman, good morning. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Billy.
I want to talk about that testimony. I want to talk about what you heard on the phone call. But we were just discussing what you said in that testimony, which is your immigrant story, that your family came here. I think you were 3 years old, came to Brooklyn. In that testimony, you touched on something that was so important, which is that you could speak out in this country, something that your father felt you couldn't do because of his own experience in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Well, I think the immigrant story is so important to so many Americans. Very few can claim that they're native. And that's something that a common thread that ties us all together. I thought that was critical to address this, especially in this moment where immigrants are being attacked. And then it also affected me deeply because I saw, had some experience with what the other side looked like, where right doesn't matter. In the United States, it does. We need to continue to make it matter. And I think that's part of the reason I wrote this book.
Seeing some pictures of you and your twin brother, also worked the National Security Council. He figures into the story of July of 2019 as well. There's a scene in the book while this is all going on and you're preparing to testify, where your father, again, based on his experience in the Soviet Union, tells you, straight up, support the president. Go out there and support President Trump.
Right.
How did you take that and what did you say back to him?
Well, I respect my dad. He always he has awesome advice, prescient advice oftentimes. But in this case, I knew exactly what the right thing to do was. And I knew that he was in part channeling his experiences and a deep fear that I would potentially end up like so many in the Soviet Union or in other authoritarian regimes end up, which is persecuted, prosecuted, and maybe even killed. And that's what he was channeling when he provided his advice.
Well, ironically, there was a grain of wisdom to what he was saying, because eventually you did leave the United States Army based on your decision to testify. So let's go back to the call. Thursday, 9:00 in the morning, July 25th, 2019, President Trump calls President Zelensky ostensibly to congratulate him on his election. What did you hear specifically on that call that raised the alarms for you?
Well, even going into the calls, I was apprehensive. I had I shouldn't have been. I put together all the talking points. I knew exactly how it should have gone. And under almost any other circumstances, except for that president, because he never really followed anything scripted or policy oriented, is almost always self-serving. But I knew that there was a risk that it would go the way we had seen it going, with the Giuliani narrative creeping in, with this demand for an investigation. There was a preceding meeting on July 10th where I also expressed my concerns to senior White House officials. And I was apprehensive because I thought that, you know, there's a chance that the president was going to go down this line. But on the other side, there was a professional military officer that refused to believe that the president was going to be complicit in this corrupt enterprise, undermining the very foundation of our election, which is a free and fair election. And that's how I walked into the call. And as soon as the president joined the line, I could tell it was going to go badly.
President Trump infamously called it a perfect phone call. What was the statement? What were the words you heard that told you, I need to go tell somebody about this?
Sure. I mean, they culminated in the most famous words. I need you to do us a favor, though. You know, apply a little bit of drama to it and a little bit of a kind of mafioso Italian accent. It comes crystal clear. But throughout the phone call, you could hear the president building towards something. He was talking about everything that the United States has done. Nobody's done more. You know, Ukraine is not appreciative. And then in response to President Zelensky's suggestion that they were going to buy more weapons that they critically needed to defend against more Russian aggression, the president responds, I need you to do us a favor, though. And then there was all sorts of other crazy stuff about CrowdStrike servers and Burisma and all these things. And, you know, I knew right away that I had to do something to get us back on track. The president flip-flopped on many issues, and with the right people counseling him, if things had gone properly, he could have been brought back onto target.
So you walk into your twin brother's office. Mm-hmm. There's part of that immigrant story, making it all the way to the White House. Twin brother's office afterward. He also worked for the National Security Council. And you say, this is what I just heard. Now, you know, by even having that conversation or entertaining the idea that we're going to push this up the chain of command, you're probably stepping into something because of who this president is and who he surrounds himself with. What was that conversation like with your brother?
So it was the amazing thing about this whole thing is I had the closest ally I could in the White House with me, my identical twin brother. We were roommates. So I speak to him on a regular basis, you know, multiple times a day. That was pretty much the only break I took. So as soon as I walked in there, he could probably sense that there was something off. I closed the door. There was a little dramatic pause. And I tell him, Eugene, if what I'm about to tell you ever becomes public, the president will be impeached. Wow. And, you know, there was a disconnect from the reality that somehow this would become public, because normally it doesn't. This is government. Everything is classified. But it did. And history unfolded with the president being impeached.
So, again, because this is Donald Trump and because he surrounds himself with people like Rudy Giuliani, you know, when you go out that you're going to be smeared. They're going to try to discredit you. They might even strip you of all the things. They obviously denied your promotion to colonel. What was the calculus in your mind in that moment of, should I do this? Should I open up Pandora's box?
So there was no hesitation on the fact that I needed to report this. It was my duty. I had sworn an oath on multiple occasions to support and defend the Constitution against enemies foreign and domestic. And there was no hesitation. I recognized I'd almost certainly be out of the White House. In the back of my mind, there was a risk to my career, but I was hopeful. I tend to be optimistic. I think one of the hardest aspects of this whole affair was that the military wasn't supportive. And in your last segment, you talked about the suicide of the police officers. I think, you know, having similar, in some ways, similar experiences, the hardest part might be, yes, the attacks on that day, but the subsequent attacks, the demonization, the character assassination from folks that they defend on a regular basis, the folks in Congress, the folks that supposedly support law enforcement, that is a difficult thing to bear. And that's, you know, it's hard to not hold a grudge. I try to not have hard feelings against an institution I served and loved for decades, but it's not easy sometimes.
So how did you process that, Colonel Vindman, when the kind of people you've served with for your entire life in the United States Army, people in the United States military, when you went to them assuming that they would take this seriously and push it up through the chain of command themselves, when you met a brick wall and they said, we don't want any part of this. In fact, we're going to push you away. Yeah. What did that feel like?
So it was pretty watching it unfold. It's hard to describe. There was no outreach. You typically in the military, you have your senior leadership is always eager to weigh in, correct you if you're doing something wrong, encourage you if you're doing something right. That's just the way the system works. That's leadership. But there was nothing. It was dead air. I had one conversation with the chief of staff of the Army. He said, do the right thing in the right way. I looked at him very puzzled. What is the right way? And I knew what the right thing was, but what does the right way mean in this context? Lieutenant Colonel challenging the commander in chief based on the president's violation of his obligations to the Constitution. Could you give me a little bit more? And, nothing.
What do you say to people who've heard your story, heard your testimony, will read this book and say, you know what? These are supporters of Donald Trump. Largely what he said was harmless. It was just Donald Trump kind of spouting off being Donald Trump. What do you say to that?
I think that we should not be dismissive. If we want right to matter, we have to make it matter. I think the Congress, the Senate in particular, Senate Republicans abrogated their responsibilities under the Constitution and under the specific oath they swore during the trial. That there's a direct logic link to the 600,000 dead. If the president was held accountable, removed, we would have 600,000 more Americans walking the streets today. If they censured him, the president would be on his heels, and he would probably have been a little more cautious going into COVID. We wouldn't have an economic disaster. If we want things to matter, we have to make it matter. And that means each one of us making our voices heard. An individual can make a difference. It's just that simple. If anything, I'm an example of that, whether that was willingly or not. I think we should keep that in mind and try to make things better.
Colonel Vindman, Jonathan Lemire with the Associated Press is here with a question for you. John?
Colonel, good morning. Thanks so much for being here. I was hoping you could walk us through, during that time when you were in the spotlight and the impeachment trial was going on, what was that like for you in terms of, were you fearful for your own safety? What sort of security measures were taken? Were you receiving threats? And a second part of that, is that still continuing now? Paint a picture for us as what your life is like after this moment. You know, you're reentering the stage with this book. Are you still fearful that some supporters of Donald Trump may make your life very difficult or even threaten you or your family?
Hi, John. So I think I was very, very focused on what I needed to do for testimony. It's you know, what we call a kind of mission oriented, laser focused on the task at hand, which was to come across as professional, impartial and direct with regards to addressing the questions of the congressman and so forth. So I also had some training in my background, time in Moscow under pretty oppressive conditions where you have the security services, you know, constantly monitoring your actions, beleaguered. So that was in the back of my mind, but I was really focused on the mission. My wife, on the other hand, was extremely, extremely concerned. She's, as my daughter says, responsible for safety. I'm responsible for fun. And she was very concerned that the letters that were coming to the home, the vitriol on the internet was going to come around in a real way and affect our lives. And at one point, we really considered moving on to an installation to protect ourselves. We didn't go to that level, but it was close. Now, I'm a little apprehensive speaking out, but like I said, if we want right to matter, we have to make it matter. And I wrote this book in part to address all of those wonderful letters of support I received from Americans, talking about my background, talking about these key elements of my upbringing, military service that allowed me to navigate things, do the right thing, potentially in the right way. I'll leave that up to you to judge. I thought it was worth expressing these thoughts.
Gene?
Colonel Vindman, this is Gene Robinson. Have any of the Republicans who defamed you and who treated you so badly apologized?
No, definitely not. I don't think it's in their DNA at the moment to do that. I had hoped at one point that the Republicans who tout themselves as defenders of the military, defenders of law enforcement, would kind of see the merits of what I'm saying. None of that really unfolded the way it did. There were a couple of Republican leaders that did reach out and were supportive. Liz Cheney reached out and spoke to my wife. I thought Mitt Romney took a principled stand. But really, those were by far the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. So, Colonel, let me just ask you about your father's faith in this country and your faith in this country. Obviously, you have a lot of reasons. Your father has a lot of reasons to still believe in the dream of America. I'm curious where you are right now on that. I remember I had a friend from Turkey, and during the Iraq War, every day he would lecture me about how bad America was. And after about the 40th consecutive lecture, I was like, dude, you can always go back to Turkey. Yes, we make mistakes and make mistakes. I mean, if you think America is such a horrible place, why are you here? And he said something I'll never forget. He said, because America, it's like a Hollywood movie. You do things bad many times, but in the end, the good guys always win. And he said, I've seen it since I've been over here, that the good guys always win in the end. And I'm curious if that's where you are now, if you believe that the good guys are winning, if you believe that accountability still counts in this country, if you believe that actually, you know, that here, right still matters.
Morning, Joe. I think your friend was channeling his Churchill, which where he said, after we try everything else, we'll do the right thing. But I do believe in this country. I think having my family's experience, my firsthand experience, whether that's in combat zones, on the border between North and South Korea, in Ukraine, in Russia, I see where challenges really are and the stark contrast that this country poses to some of the hardships that people face in other countries. And this country is unique. It's a wonderful place. At times, I can't deny that some of my faith was shaken, you know, vibrated. I don't think shaken is a little too strong. But I always fell in back on the fact that this country is constantly moving forward, striving towards that more perfect union. Many, many missteps along the way, but we are slowly, slowly progressing. It's hard to see that at this moment where we're so divided and the rhetoric is so acute. But I do have great faith in this country. And that's why I'm wearing this flag here.
Mika, this last bit is for you, Colonel Vindman, you were telling me in the commercial break. So he's working on his PhD, and he has got the thesis approved, I believe. And how does it begin?
So it starts with a quote by your father in which he says, it cannot be stressed enough that Russia without Ukraine ceases to become an empire, but with Ukraine subordinated and suborned automatically becomes an empire. And that encapsulates, frankly, the import of Ukraine to U.S. national security. That Russia becomes even a more potent adversary. And I thank you and your father for offering that wisdom to me.
I'm honored that you would bring my father's quote into this. And I wonder, a little bit similar to Joe's question, but after all you've been through and where we're going now, are you still hopeful about America as a democracy?
I am. I've got a wonderful wife, a beautiful 10-year-old daughter, super happy. I'm able to really, especially if people don't recognize me straight off, it might be harder after these appearances. I could have a conversation with anybody, even if they're, I consider myself a moderate on the left, on the right. I could have a conversation with anybody and probably come to some common understandings. We all kind of care about some very core issues. We're still kind of the same people fundamentally. It's the rhetoric that's being driven by politicians, self-serving politicians, that is really interfering with us and driving us apart. So I think that's something that we could overcome. And again, this book kind of, I think, is a hopeful story about being able to live with the decisions you make, navigating difficult affairs, and coming through on the other side, prepared to rebuild and build back better.
You've said many times, if we want right to matter, we have to make it matter. Nothing is inevitable. We have to work at it. Thank you for reminding us what right is. The book is Here, Right Matters, An American Story. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, thank you so much for being here today. Congratulations on the book, and thank you for doing the right thing.
Thank you for having
me. Nice to see you. Mika?
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.